on the 757. He wasn't as sure about the A321. He questioned her, and she nodded slowly, thinking back to when she had come on duty and what she'd seen. But nothing had seemed unusual to her until she found the postcard in the bin. "What did you notice about the crew?" Ben asked her intensely. "Any small, odd detail?" Bernice closed her eyes for a minute, trying to remember everything. "I noticed that the pilot was a woman, and she looked friendly and nice. She wasn't talking much, but she seemed pleasant. And the co-pilot was kind of a smartass. He made a nasty comment about most of the TSA agents being African-American, and the pilot called him on it and threatened to write him up. He didn't say anything after that. The flight attendants didn't do or say anything special. They went through pretty quickly. They always do." Ben nodded. It wasn't the flight attendants he was concerned about. It was the cockpit crew. "If we're looking for trouble," he said quietly, in the privacy of the room, after he asked Bernice to leave for a few minutes, "we have the potential for it with any of the flight crew on the A321. We have a pilot who had a TIA 2 days ago, which caused a decision to retire him immediately after a distinguished 40-year career. He could be bitter about it, angry at the airline, or even suicidal. He has no psychiatric history, but his wife died last year. Now he's lost his job. He could be planning some kind of revenge on the airline, and if he is, this is his last chance. He's in the perfect place to do that. He's in the cockpit, and he sure as hell knows how to fly that plane. Helen Smith has gone through more than any human being ever should for the past 2 years. She left the Air Force, which is the only life she ever knew. She grew up with her father, an Air Force colonel. She came to work for the airline and expected her husband to join her months later. Instead, he was shot down in Iraq, taken prisoner, and the whole world watched him get his head sliced off on TV. I'm not sure how you recover from that. She's living in an unfamiliar place, managing 3 kids. I don't know if she has money troubles or not, but she has every right to a psychotic break, or could even want to commit suicide. I can't imagine her doing it and taking a whole plane of people down with her, with her record. But if she snapped, no one would be surprised. He himself had been through so much less than that when the hostages were killed, and he had thought of suicide several times after it happened, out of remorse over the way it had turned out and the people who had died. But he didn't say that to Dave and Amanda, who were listening raptly to him. She may feel guilty for leaving Iraq before he did, or have survivor guilt. There's no sign of it, but she would have a right to mental problems more than anyone I know. And Jason Andrews is a loose cannon. It's all here in his files. Every kind of insubordination and attitude problem. He's probably mad at the airline for slowing his progress down because of it. He's been passed over for several promotions because of his attitude, not his skills. It says here that he's a more than capable pilot, but he can't keep his mouth shut. And he was referred to anger management classes 2 years ago. From what I'm reading here, I'm surprised they haven't fired him. He sounds like a giant pain in the ass. And if they do fire him, he can look forward to life as a waiter. Flying is the only thing he knows, and no one is going to hire him as a pilot if the airline lets him go. Ben summed it up. So there you have it. We have 3 people in that cockpit, 2 of whom could want to commit suicide, especially Connor Gray, who has nothing to look forward to and no future ahead of him. And Jason Andrews is a wild card, with some kind of anger management problem we don't know enough about. How angry is he? How far will he go? Does he have a girlfriend? Dave asked Ben quietly, and Ben looked in the confidential file about him. I don't know. He lived with a woman he had listed as next of kin, but she's not listed anymore. Why don't you send someone to talk to her? She may know something we don't and shed some light on what he's capable of and just how angry he is. Maybe we have nothing to worry about. The girlfriends always know. Good point, Ben said, and was going to call Phil and ask him to arrange it, when Amanda finally spoke up. She had read the files thoroughly, too, and had been unusually quiet. Now she had on her serious, professional face when she spoke. I completely disagree with you, she said to Ben. I don't think you understand the psychology of these people, or 2 of them, anyway. Connor knew he had to retire next year anyway. Shortening it by a year is not going to make a man of his caliber commit suicide. I'm sure he has plans for his retirement. He may be intending to start a business or spend time with his grandchildren. He's not going to take a plane down and murder innocent passengers on his way out. It's not in his character. His wife has been dead for a year. Why would he commit suicide over it now? And it says in his file she'd been sick for several years. It doesn't sound like it came as a shock. And Jason Andrews may be a hothead, but he has a brilliant career ahead of him. Everything in his file says he's an outstanding pilot. So he has a big mouth, and he's been delayed for promotion a couple of times. So what? He's not going to destroy his life, take out a national landmark, and kill innocent people because it's taken him a year or two longer to become a captain. That would be insane. And even if he has an anger problem, he may put a fist through a wall or mouth off at a coworker, but he is not going to kill 111 people, including himself. It's just not in his psychological profile. Trust me, he's not going to give up his future at his age. The one I'm worried about is Helen Smith. I don't think anyone can survive what she's been through without deep emotional scars and smoldering anger, none of which shows until the day she loses it and shoots 20 people in a supermarket or takes down a plane. She has every reason to be furious at life. The truth is, she got screwed. What happened to her just isn't fair. I couldn't watch my husband get beheaded on video and ever lead a normal life again. I think she's an accident waiting to happen, and I'm shocked that the airline didn't think so too, and that she is still flying. If we do have a problem, I think she's it. She has the potential to be a very dangerous person, to herself and passengers on the plane. She's our prime candidate for a suicidal psychotic break. There was no arguing with the extent of Amanda's education, but Ben didn't agree with a word she said. I think you're dead wrong about her, Ben said firmly. And about the others, too. I think Connor Gray probably is suicidally depressed. And Jason Andrews sounds like such an unbridled asshole, he probably could kill 111 people in a rage. More if he were flying a bigger plane. Amanda looked seriously annoyed to be contradicted and kept arguing with Ben about it when his cell phone rang, and it was Phil. He had heard back from the CIA. "Your Arab couple are okay," Phil said, sounding embarrassed. "They're both from prominent Saudi families. Ahmed, the husband, is a member of the Saudi royal family. They're here as students and starting classes at UC Berkeley in a few days. They're as far from terrorists as you can get. They're on student visas. He's enrolled at the business school, and she's getting a master's in art history. They're not going to take down your plane. So where does that leave us? Do we have a situation on our hands or not?" Phil asked, sounding worried, but relieved about the young couple at least. "We're still trying to figure that out," Ben said quietly. "This narrows the field considerably. We're worried about the cockpit crew on the first plane. We have three potentially explosive scenarios and some complicated psychological issues. It's credible that any one of the three could try to take the plane down, though we don't agree on who. And I don't know if any of them would want to take out the Golden Gate Bridge in the process, but I think the co-pilot is capable of it. So do we pull out all the stops and try to stop something from happening that maybe was never going to happen in the first place? Do we make fools of ourselves trying to save a plane that's not at risk? Or do we let it go and end up regretting it when it turns out that we weren't paranoid in the first place? Intelligently, I don't think anything's going to happen here. It's all too unlikely. But my instincts are shrieking at me, and my gut tells me that a disaster is going to happen if we don't try to stop it." Dave was nodding as Ben said it. He agreed with him, and Amanda was pointing at Helen's personnel file with a look of determination. "Personally, I agree with you on most points," Phil told him on the speakerphone. "I think we're all letting our imaginations run away with us. A random postcard does not a disaster make. And I don't see how any airline could be employing three pilots who would be capable of taking down a plane on a suicide mission. And those are three-star pilots we're talking about, or two of them, at least. But having said that, I don't know why. I have a bad feeling about this, too. This is the kind of situation we read about now too often, and no one saw coming. If we think there is any chance that what we fear here could, in fact, become a reality, then I think we have to do everything we can to stop it, even if we look like idiots later. If we turn out to be wrong, I'd rather look like a fool than have dead passengers. That's the kind of direction I'm leaning, Ben said, reassured to hear what Phil thought about it. I just have a nasty feeling that, as crazy as it sounds, all based on a flimsy postcard, I think it could happen. Then let's get serious about it, Phil said, relieving Ben of some of the responsibility of the decision. Let's put up all the roadblocks we can and hope to hell the problem isn't on the 757 and we missed it. That's not going to happen. I don't see any potential there. No passengers stand out and the crew are clean, Ben said firmly, with conviction. I think we know where the problem is, if there is one, on which plane, and I think there is only one of the three pilots who would do it. Jason Andrews. The others are too responsible. It's not in their DNA to bring down a plane for any reason. By the way, the airline gave us another detail on Helen Smith. Her daughter is neurologically handicapped in some way. She has a mild form of disability. As her children's only parent, she's not going to abandon her, or any of her kids. That clinches it for me, Ben said firmly. I think Andrews is our man. The question is, what do we do to stop him? Ben thought about it for a minute and knew what he had to do, or to at least get started. The plane is due to land at SFO at approximately 11 a.m. local time. I want the Golden Gate Bridge closed at 10 for construction. They can tell people there's a serious gas leak, which will keep away the curious. And I want Coast Guard rescue boats in the water in case he gets that far. Let's not take any chances. Phil noticed that Ben sounded like his old self again, from before the hostage situation, and was pleased to hear it. He was not afraid to make decisions or trust his gut. What about the captain? Are you going to tell her? Phil wanted to know. I have to tell her something, Ben answered. I'll clear the Arab couple, of course, but I need to warn her she could have a serious problem in the cockpit. She has to be prepared for it. Maybe it's a good thing that Connor Gray is there with her. I'll call her on the SATCOM in a few minutes, and then I'll come back to the office. He wanted to be at home base with all this happening, not in the TSA supervisor's office at Terminal 2. Ben suggested they take Bernice with them, and Dave had already said he would come along. Ben hung up with Phil and saw Amanda staring at him in a fury. Do you realize what you're doing? You're backing the wrong horse here. What if I'm right, and Helen is the most likely to bring that plane down? The death of more than 100 people is going to be your responsibility if you make it possible for her to do that. The force of what she said hit him like a wrecking ball, especially after what had recently happened with the hostages. It's a chance we have to take. I'm in charge here, and I take full responsibility for my decisions, Ben said in an icy tone which didn't stop her. If you're wrong, I'll see to it that our superiors know about it and that I advised you against it. Don't worry, Amanda, he said bitterly. If I'm wrong, you won't have to get me fired. Next time, I'll quit. He almost had this time, and Phil had talked him out of it and insisted that no one could have foreseen that the hostages would be killed, and any of them in authority could have made the decision to go in when they did. They had agreed with Ben on it 100%. You have no psychological training or insights, Amanda insisted, adamant in her own position. I listened to you. It's all a grab bag of guesswork with you. There's no science to it. She was frustrated and furious at him. She thought he was sloppy and unprofessional. It's called experience, he responded. With you, it's all out of books you read. You don't know what you're talking about. I've been in the field here for 20 years. You can't learn this stuff in books. You have to know people. Like you knew the hostage takers? It was a cheap shot, and she knew it, and regretted it as soon as she said it. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. I just think you're wrong about Helen Smith. I think she's going to be the one to bring that plane down. Amanda was certain of it. Maybe none of them will, Ben said honestly. We're starting from a postcard that may not mean a goddamn thing. It's all guesswork. All we can do is prepare for the worst and see what happens. And if nothing happens and we all look like fools, so much the better. I'd like to have egg on my face for a change. It might feel better than watching people die when we could have prevented it. He couldn't have stopped the hostage's death, but he still thought he might have. "That's my point," Amanda said grimly. "Get Helen Smith out of the cockpit. Jason Andrews is the only one up there with a future. Trust him. He's not going to bring that plane down. He may save it for you." Ben looked at her and shook his head. "I'm sorry, I can't." And with that, he walked out of the terminal with Amanda and asked Bernice to join them. He wasn't going to explain it to Amanda again. She didn't get it. Bernice looked overwhelmed by what she'd heard before she left the room, and the knowledge that she had started it. Denise watched her leave the building with them and wondered what would happen next. Ben had made it clear to all that no one was to talk to the press. Dave was lagging behind, talking on his cell phone. When he caught up, he looked at Ben with an exasperated expression. "Great. We've got a guy on the plane who kidnapped his infant son from his estranged wife. She's hysterical. He left a note telling her he's on this flight. He's on the A321, and the police are going to pick him up at the San Francisco airport. He's in arrears on child support payments. He's got the kid, who's 10 months old, and he has a connecting flight to Japan. So we've got to nab him at the gate and put the kid in protective custody. Jesus, can anything else happen on that flight?" "Let's hope not," Ben said as they drove back to his office, where Phil was waiting for them. Phil could easily sense the tension between Amanda and Ben when they sat down for a meeting. She shared her theories about Helen, and Phil listened to her intently and spoke to her apologetically when she finished. Her theories made sense only to her. No one else agreed, and neither did he. "I've got to go with Ben on this," he told her kindly. He didn't want to offend her, but after reading the personnel files himself, he thought Ben was right. Helen had been through hell, but was solid as a rock. Connor was an honorable man, and must surely be depressed over losing his career, but not to the point of killing 111 people. If there was a plot, which no one knew for sure, Jason was their man. They all believed it after what they'd read about him. The first thing Ben did when he got back to his office was to call Alan Wexler, the head of the San Francisco Homeland Security Office, to have him send agents to talk to Jason's ex-girlfriend in San Francisco. She was a nurse at UCSF Medical Center, and he wanted to know more about Jason's anger problem, and just how far she thought he would go, if she would talk to them. And then he called Helen on the SATCOM to bring her up to date. "We're not sure, but we think we have a problem on your flight," he said cautiously. "We don't know anything certain at this point. We're just guessing, based on what we do know and can piece together. But I don't think the concern is with the passenger list," he said quietly. "Your Arab couple are fine, by the way. They're Saudi royals on their way to grad school. I think the problem may be in the cockpit." There was silence at her end for a long moment as she tried to absorb it and what that meant for her. "Do you understand me, Captain?" "I think I do." She didn't suspect Connor Gray. Her co-pilot was a far more likely candidate to cause trouble, and she didn't argue with Ben about it. She thought he might be right, if there really was a problem. "Are you having any issues now?" Ben asked her. "We're fine," she said, and sounded convincing. And it was true. Jason had been quiet for the last hour, and hadn't spoken to her or Connor. He had been lost in thought, as he sat in his seat with the plane on autopilot, but there was no way to know what he was thinking. "We'll stay in touch with you," Ben told Helen. "We're gathering more information now. By the way, we've got a parental abduction situation in Coach, but that's under control and it's not your problem." She laughed ruefully as he said it. "Anything else?" And she had thought it would be an easy flight. "We'll keep you posted," Ben promised. "I'll look forward to it." She sounded cool and calm. The fighter pilot in her had taken over, her head clear even under fire in combat. "And don't let him do the landing at SFO," he warned her. "Definitely not," she said pointedly, and hung up a moment later. She glanced over at Jason after the call ended and told him that the Arab couple had checked out, were Saudi royals and weren't a problem. He listened to her and nodded and didn't say a word, and she went back to watching the blue sky ahead of them. They were 3 hours out of San Francisco, halfway through the trip. As Ben hung up after speaking with Helen, Phil Carson walked into his office with the manifest of the first flight in his hands. The second flight was no longer an issue. "I just saw an interesting name on here," Phil said as he sat down and handed Ben the list, and pointed to a name close to the top. "It rang a bell for me, and I looked him up. Thomas Burney. He's the American rep of the manufacturer of the plane. I read somewhere that he had some corporate issue with the CEO of the company, and he was going to quit. He's ex-U.S. military, and he has top security clearance. Maybe he can help us on the flight." With no air marshal, they needed all the help they could get. "He's retired Air Force. If we need someone to check out what's going on in the cockpit, he could step in and see what's up. He has a plausible excuse for a courtesy visit to the flight deck. Captain Smith may need a helping hand. See if you can get his email address from the company. They've got Wi-Fi on the flight. We could send him an email." It sounded like a good idea to Ben, and he called the New York company office immediately. He noticed that Amanda had gone back to her office. Bernice was sitting in a chair in the waiting area, and several of the senior agents had walked into Ben's office after Phil explained the problem to them. They had a possible suicide flight, without absolute certainty about who the suicide pilot might be, and only a hunch to go on. All they knew, whatever the plot, if there was one, was that it had to be foiled. And they had exactly 3 hours to do it. The head of the aircraft manufacturer's U.S. office in New York took Ben's call, was extremely cooperative, and gave him Tom Burney's email address. As soon as he established that Ben worked for Homeland Security, and that there was a security issue that they needed to contact Tom about, they asked if there was anything they could do to help, and Ben said there wasn't, but they were fully supportive and sympathetic. As Bernice sat in the hallway, waiting for further news and developments, Della called her and asked what was going on. "A lot right now, but maybe nothing. A lot of wild stuff is happening." And she had started the whole thing with the postcard she'd found, but she didn't say anything to Della. She called Toby's school then and asked them to keep him in daycare. She could see that there was no way she'd pick him up on time, because they wanted her to stick around. If it got too late, she'd have to ask her neighbor to pick him up. After she hung up, she sat thinking about everything she'd heard since she'd called airport security. She just hoped that Homeland Security would manage to save the plane and the people on it. She didn't even want to think about what might have happened if she'd listened to her supervisor and hadn't called. Chapter 6. Robert Bond had been holding his baby for the past 3 hours, and Scott hadn't stopped screaming, as though he knew that something was wrong. His father couldn't explain to him that everything was going to be okay. They were going on a nice trip together. They would stay in San Francisco for a day, and that night they were flying to Japan. Robert just needed time to think, and he wanted to be alone with Scott, without Ellen telling him how many hours he could have the baby for and what time he had to be back with him. It was always less time than he wanted, and seemed fair to him. And in their provisional custody agreement, the female judge had agreed with Ellen that the baby was too young to spend the night with his father, and to make sure it stayed that way, Ellen was still nursing him full-time. She had added baby food, fruits, and cereal to his diet, but she wanted the baby to be dependent on her. Robert had thought they had been ready for children, but clearly they were not. Everything had changed, and not for the better, the moment Scott arrived, and even in the months before. He had no ties to Japan. He just wanted to get as far away from her as he could. He was going to bring the baby back eventually, in a month or two, and maybe by then she'd be more reasonable. He had left her a nice note, explaining everything to her and how he felt about it. He had been so in love with her before they married and for the first year, but her pregnancy had changed her. She focused only on the baby, and when Scott had been born, it only got worse. Now she was obsessed with their child and no longer cared about him, or even wanted to be married to him. Everything had to be perfect and baby-proof. They lived with monitors and gates and baby equipment everywhere. It all had to be done the way she wanted it. She refused to go back to work, and they couldn't even afford to go to a movie. Her parents paid for everything and ran the show. Robert had been saving for months without telling her, and now he was going to Tokyo and Kyoto with his son. He loved everything he'd seen about Japan on the Internet. The people were polite, the country was clean. He was going to rent a room in a mountain town somewhere after they visited Tokyo, and he was going to discover fatherhood on his own. He was 25 years old, and he hadn't been ready for it, and didn't want the baby at first, but now he was going to embrace being a parent wholeheartedly. They had been separated for 6 months. Ellen said he was irresponsible, and she wanted a divorce. Her parents had invited her to live with them, and she had agreed, which was intolerable for him. His own parents had never approved of her and refused to let him stay with them now. They said he had wanted to be an adult, so he had to be one and figure things out for himself. So he had. He hadn't hidden what he was doing or where he was going. He just hadn't told anyone. He had gotten Scott a passport one afternoon when Ellen had to go somewhere, and she let Robert take him to the park. Since no one would help him, he had taken the baby without Ellen's permission, letting himself in through the garage. He knew what time she showered after her parents left for work. It had all been easy until now. All Scott had done since they boarded the flight was scream and pull on his ear. Robert was sitting next to a heavy-set woman with bleached blonde hair, wearing sickeningly sweet perfume. She was the leader of some kind of group of girls who were sitting all around them and ignoring whatever she said to them. The woman had told him that she thought the baby had an earache, but Robert had no idea how to tell. He had never been with the baby for long on his own till then. He was planning to email Ellen from Japan in a couple of days and tell her they had arrived and the baby was safe. She'd have to live without him until they got back. She couldn't tell him what to do now, and neither could the court. He had taken matters into his own hands. In his mind, now he was what they all had kept telling him to be, an adult. It all made sense to him. On Robert's other side was a couple who hadn't stopped arguing since they sat down. They were going to his sister's wedding in California, which she didn't want to do. She said his family was always nasty to her, and Robert knew just how she felt. She hated the sister who was getting married, and reminded her husband that he didn't get along with her either, and couldn't stand the man she was marrying, who he thought was a crook. So why were they going, and why did they have to stay with his parents, who criticized her the whole time they were there, whenever they went? But he said he didn't like her parents either, and they treated him like dirt. Her sisters wouldn't talk to him, her brother was stoned whenever they saw him, and her cousin was a drug dealer and belonged in jail. It had gone on endlessly. Robert missed hearing some of it because of the baby's screaming, which drowned them out, but it was like watching reality TV. On top of it, she said she hated their apartment in Queens, and if he'd get a better job, they could move into a decent apartment and she could get pregnant. She was 36 years old. They'd been married for 8 years, and her clock was ticking. But he said he wasn't ready for kids, and he liked the job he had. He just didn't like her family any more than she liked his. It sounded like one of those, "Can this marriage be saved?" programs, and in Robert's opinion, it couldn't. The two flight attendants were talking about them, too. "Oh, Jesus, have you been listening to the pair arguing?" Bobby asked Annette. "I think they're going to kill each other before we land. Maybe we should make an announcement, asking if there's a marriage counselor on the plane," Annette said and rolled her eyes and laughed. "They're a great reason to stay single. She's been crying for most of the flight, and he sounds like a jerk." Bobby agreed with her. "I had a relationship like that once. I stuck it out for 4 years. I have no idea why. I think I was just scared I wouldn't find anyone else. I felt like I'd gotten out of prison the day he left," Annette said with a sigh. "My parents' marriage sounded like them," Bobby commented. "They got it right the second time, with other people," she added with a smile. "Do you think that baby will ever stop screaming?" Annette said with a look of despair. "Yeah, he'll fall asleep in the last 5 minutes of the flight. Kids like that give babies a bad name," Bobby said, and they both laughed. "It's not the kids, it's the parents. The dad has no idea what he's doing with that child. I think it might be sick." That's what the woman sitting next to him told him. "Watch out for the little choristers, by the way. They keep stealing our snacks. Don't you just love working in coach?" "Yeah, love it. Not," There were two of them, and with 72 passengers in coach on a fully booked plane, a screaming baby, and 14 young girls running around loose, it had been a tough flight. Someone had smoked weed in the only toilet that was working, and the flight attendants were convinced it was one or several of the older girls from the chorus, and the chaperone didn't give a damn. The girls had told them that they were going to San Francisco and Seattle to perform, and then flying back to New York. They were a rowdy group, and the chaperone paid no attention to what they were doing. As far as she was concerned, they were safe on the plane and couldn't go anywhere, so she didn't have to watch them. She'd had her earphones on for most of the trip and was watching a movie, but at least she couldn't hear the baby crying. Although for those sitting near her, the smell of her perfume was almost worse than the screaming infant. Bobby went up to business class to visit Nancy and Joel again and looked at them with envy. It had been a peaceful trip for them, except for the momentary alert about the Arab couple, which turned out to be a false alarm, and they were both asleep in their seats. He had mellowed out after the first 2 hours on the flight and watched a movie until he dozed off, and the word that had filtered down was that they were a Saudi prince and princess. The report from coach was dizzying, and made the business class flight attendants happy they weren't in the main cabin. The two flight attendants in first class had reported that Susan Farrow was a dream and had signed autographs for them. It had warmed them up considerably, and Nancy hadn't wanted to tell anyone, but finally couldn't resist and confided to Bobby that she had just found out that morning before the flight that she was pregnant. She couldn't keep it to herself a minute longer. She beamed while she said it, and Bobby congratulated her and hugged her. "I'm old enough to have a kid in college," she said seriously, "but I don't care. We've waited so long for this. I don't want to do anything to screw it up. I'd probably never get pregnant again. This was a miracle." They talked about it for a few more minutes, and then Bobby left. Joel came back from delivering a drink to a passenger and started talking about his wedding again. They all had their lives to go home to and couldn't wait. They would be landing in 2.5 hours. On the ground, Ben, Phil, Dave, Amanda, and half a dozen Homeland Security agents were actively debating if they should instruct the captain to bring the flight down at another airport before they reached San Francisco. But they didn't have enough conclusive evidence to go on, just a postcard that might mean nothing and their collective gut. And if they landed early, roughly halfway through the flight, it could cause panic and drama on board, possibly for nothing. Phil's conclusion, as senior officer, was that they didn't have anything concrete to justify landing the flight now. If something changed, they would, or could consider it seriously. But for now, they all agreed after half an hour, it was best to let the flight proceed to SFO. They still had time to change their minds. They all felt confident that Helen was competent enough to handle whatever happened in the air, which hopefully would not include a harrowing detour to the Golden Gate Bridge. And if they changed the flight plan now, they were afraid that Jason might try something dangerous or dramatic wherever they were. They had one advantage with the A321. If they did decide to land early, they wouldn't have to dump fuel, which could have been an additional problem on another plane. The plane they were using could land fully loaded, so full fuel tanks were not an issue. But their decision in any case was to keep the flight on course and in the air. "Let's go for it," Ben said quietly. "We'll stay with the approved flight plan and land at SFO. Helen didn't know that they'd been thinking of changing the final destination, and they didn't tell her, since their conclusion was to stick with landing the plane at SFO, but it had been a serious debate. Ben and his team had to take it all under serious consideration, and they had no certain knowledge that the flight was in danger, only a postcard and a guess. And admitting to a threat of some kind would attract the attention of the media even before they landed, and could provoke an instant reaction from Jason. It seemed safer to identify and neutralize him, and bring the plane in according to plan. Catherine James was still wide awake and sending emails, and had been for several hours. She had taken her suit jacket off and rolled up the sleeves of her silk blouse. She was having a town car pick her up at the airport to take her to Palo Alto for her meeting. She desperately wanted the job, and to make a good impression. So she didn't drink any more wine or champagne after takeoff, although she was still slightly nervous about the flight. But there had been no turbulence. It had been a smooth ride all the way from New York, and they only had 2 hours left. As much as she hated flying, she knew she could manage that. The man next to her had worked as long as she had, and when she asked him what he did, he said he was an aeronautical engineer, and she looked impressed. "The company I work for built this plane," he said, and smiled at her. She had turned out to be neither drunk nor talkative, so he was friendlier than he had been at the beginning of the flight. He had asked her where she was going, and she said to a meeting in Palo Alto. She said she was hoping to move to California, if things went well. He didn't tell her that he had quit his job recently and had been interviewing in New York. He had another month to finish out his contract and was staying till the end. As one of the top people in management in the company, he felt he had a responsibility to them, especially when his leaving was reported in the New York Times. They were still trying to convince him to stay, but Tom thought their disagreements had been too severe. He didn't like the attitude of the CEO. There was a battle of wills between Tom and the head of the New York office, and he felt the CEO hadn't supported him, so on principle he was leaving. He had been interviewing with similar firms in the East, but he hadn't found one he liked as much yet. He had loved working where he was and didn't want to change, but he felt he couldn't stay, with a personality clash with his superior. He had one more company in L.A. to meet with in 2 weeks, and then he planned to make a decision about his future. In his current job, he commuted between their New York office and one in San Francisco. He asked Catherine then about her job, and she said she worked in finance, at a Wall Street firm for the moment, but it had been her dream for years to work in venture capital in Silicon Valley, and now it was happening. The job she was interviewing for had fallen into her lap. "I broke up with my boyfriend recently," she said as they chatted, "so it seemed like a good time to make the move." Tom had wondered if she was single or divorced, and whether she had kids, but hadn't wanted to ask. And he thought her comment about her recent breakup was an encouraging detail, having noticed again how attractive she was and how shapely her legs were. He was chatting with her when the email from Ben Waterman came in. It said only that they were having some security concerns about the flight, and would appreciate it if he would stop in the cockpit for a few minutes and then give them a temperature reading in New York about the atmosphere he encountered and any observations about the flight crew. Tom frowned as he read it, and Catherine noticed his change of expression immediately. The email also said that they had advised Captain Smith of a courtesy visit from him once they knew he was on the flight. "Something wrong?" Catherine asked. She hoped she didn't sound too neurotic, but was sure she did. But given what she knew of his job now, she figured he'd be one of the first to know if there was a problem with the plane. "Of course not." He smiled at her. "Everything's fine," he said calmly. "In 2 hours we'll be on the ground, and you'll be off to your meeting, and you'll knock 'em dead," he said pleasantly, and as he stood up, presumably to use the restroom, she pulled her legs close to her so he could get by her. She smiled as he walked past. She watched him go, thinking that he was good-looking. She noticed that he wasn't wearing a wedding ring. She was wondering if he just didn't wear one or wasn't married, when she saw him walk past the restroom, stop and say something to the purser in first class, and then knock on the cockpit door, and she stiffened. The co-pilot opened it immediately when Tom identified himself, since the captain had been advised of a social visit and she had just notified the purser that Tom had clearance to enter and was expected. Catherine saw the exchange, and Tom disappeared inside, which made her anxious again about what the email had said. Why would her seatmate go to the cockpit immediately after receiving an email? He had looked serious as he read it, and had gotten up and gone forward almost immediately. She wondered if he had lied to her, knowing how nervous she was on the flight and had been in the beginning. Maybe something was wrong with the plane. She glanced out the window, but saw no sign of smoke or fire in the engines. Once inside, Tom greeted all three pilots, and Helen looked happy to see him when he introduced himself. They chatted easily for a few minutes, since she and Tom had both been in the Air Force. He commented that it had been a pleasant flight, and noticed that Jason was watching him intently. Tom turned to talk to him then, and thought the young co-pilot looked tense. Tom asked about the plane's performance, to justify his visit and not arouse suspicion, and Helen said it was a pleasure to fly. No complaints, then? Nothing you'd like to see changed? We like feedback from our pilots on an ongoing basis. It was true, but also covered his appearance in the cockpit. He didn't know what problems they were having, but he sensed that the atmosphere was strained, although Captain Smith seemed cool and professional. He lingered with them to try to understand the tension he was feeling. He wasn't sure if the pilot and co-pilot didn't like each other, or if there was a problem or had been a disagreement of some kind. He could sense the newly retired captain watching him, too. There was definitely an awed atmosphere among the three pilots, but he couldn't put his finger on it. Nothing in Helen's face betrayed it. He saw her make some notes in a log as they drew closer to San Francisco, and Jason seemed anxious for Tom to leave. He finally ran out of excuses to stay, shook hands with all three of them, thanked Helen for a smooth flight, and was startled to feel a small slip of paper in the palm of his hand when Helen shook his. Fortunately, he had shaken her hand last. As he left with a final wave, he slipped the paper into his pocket, went into the restroom afterward and read it. She had given him all the emergency access and override codes to the cockpit. Ben had been right. Something was amiss if she felt a need to give them to him. After that, he hurried back to his seat to contact Ben, waiting with the others at Homeland Security for his report. "Everything okay?" Catherine asked him again as he got back into his seat, after carefully stepping over her. "I saw you go into the cockpit," she said, worried. "Courtesy visit." He smiled at her and picked up his computer again. The codes were in his pocket, and he wanted to fill Ben in immediately. He told him what had happened, and said there was a feeling of tension in the cockpit, but he couldn't explain it or see any reason for it. The captain had been congenial. Connor Gray was quiet, and the co-pilot seemed anxious and in a hurry for him to leave. Ben didn't like the sound of it. The whole day had been fraught with the same kind of feeling, of some major piece of the puzzle missing, and all his instincts shrieking. Why was Jason in a hurry for Tom to leave? And Helen must have sensed danger if she'd given Tom the access codes to the cockpit. "I think there's trouble on the flight," Ben said to Phil, and told him about the paper Helen had given Tom, and Phil looked unhappy about it. "That doesn't sound good to me." It confirmed their suspicions and fears about the flight, and gave credence to their theories, even if they had no proof of a problem or solid evidence of it, until the slip of paper with the codes. "It doesn't to me either," Ben agreed, as Amanda walked into his office and sat down. She had gone back to her own office for a while, in order to get away from what she considered too much testosterone in one place, which in her mind accounted for their refusing to believe any of her theories about Helen Smith. She was a woman and knew how women's minds worked, and she was sure she had gotten it right and the captain was about to snap, or already had, and they were going to see some terrifying sign of it. Ben and Phil were afraid of something even worse. When Tom Burney left the cockpit, Jason looked at Helen suspiciously. "What was that about? Was he checking up on me?" "Of course not. Why would he?" she said, starting to put her things away to get ready for their approach and landing. They were still 200 miles away, which wouldn't take long to cover, and she was going to report to the tower in a minute. She'd already done so earlier, but needed to check with them again when they were in closer range. "He doesn't work for the airline," she reminded Jason. "You heard what he said. They like getting feedback from the pilots, about how their planes perform. It's nice for them to have some input and for us to talk to them directly." "Then why didn't he ask me?" he asked angrily, glaring at her, and she could see his temper starting to flare. "He did. He asked all of us." She included Connor in her answer, too, since he had been flying the same planes until only days before, and Tom didn't know he was recently retired. "You could have said something if you wanted to." "I didn't want to," he snapped at her. "I don't care how they build their goddamn planes. The airline doesn't let me fly them anyway." He sat in the co-pilot's chair and sulked, waiting for her to let him do the landing at SFO. She hadn't told him yet that she wasn't going to. She was saving that piece of news for the last minute, so he'd have less time to react, in case he flew into a rage over it. Ben responded to Tom's email immediately, and told him to be on the alert for anything unusual happening. And Catherine continued to scrutinize him as he answered Ben's email. She had a sixth sense that something was wrong, and Tom wasn't telling her. But they were strangers, and he was too professional to say anything about Ben's warnings to him from the ground. Nancy was making cookies in the galley, and Joel was plating them to offer passengers before they landed. They still had to pick up the earphones in business and first class and do minor housekeeping before the end of the flight. Nancy used the opportunity to send her husband a quick email. She had never done that before, but suddenly wanted to, and all she wrote to him was, "I love you." His response came back almost instantly, concerned about her. "Something wrong?" he asked. "Of course not," she answered back, and his response was quick. "In that case, I love you too. See you tonight." He was just leaving Miami on a delayed flight, but she could wait to tell him the news until that night. It had taken 12 years to get here. A few more hours wouldn't hurt, and they had a lot to talk about, like the adoption of the little girl in China. What were they going to do about that now? And then, trying not to think about it, she took the trays of cookies around, while Joel collected the headphones. The Saudi couple each accepted a cookie and smiled at her. They were excited to be approaching their new life in Berkeley. He looked far more relaxed than when he boarded, as he chatted with his wife. Nancy gave 2 cookies each to Mark and Nicole, who were looking forward to seeing their grandparents, and she noticed that Tom Burney and Catherine James were talking, and they were smiling. She wondered if a romance had started on the flight. They were both good-looking people in their early 40s. Stranger things had happened, and they'd had plenty of time to talk. When she finished offering the cookies, she went back to the galley, and a few minutes later, Joel returned with the headphones. People hated to give them up before their movies were over, but the crew had to pick them up an hour before they landed, and warned people of it at the beginning of the flight, but no one ever remembered, and then got annoyed at the flight attendants when they followed the rules and reclaimed them. In coach, the screaming baby had gotten worse, and Monique Lalou, the chorus chaperone, turned to Robert again with a look of concern. "Your baby is bright red. I think he has a fever." As she said it, the baby projectile vomited all over her, and she looked horrified. The smell was ghastly, and Bobby rushed to the bathroom to bring them wet towels, but there was very little they could do to repair the damage. Robert apologized profusely. "I don't know what's wrong with him," Robert said, looking panicked. "You should take him to a doctor," Monique said angrily. "He's been sick for the entire flight. You shouldn't be traveling with him." The smell of vomit was everywhere, and the couple on his other side covered their noses in revulsion as the husband whispered to his wife, "You want one of those? I sure don't." "He was cute before he threw up," she said half-heartedly. "No, he wasn't. He's been screaming since we took off." The remainder of the flight in coach was going to be very unpleasant, and Robert was wondering what to do when he landed. He didn't know where to find a doctor, and he couldn't call Ellen to ask her. He didn't want to contact her again until he got to Tokyo. He had a plan, and he was going to stick to it. For once in his life, he was going to do what he wanted, and not what everyone told him to do. But he could feel how hot the baby was in his arms. The woman from the chorus was right. He had a fever. He'd have to take him to an emergency room for some medicine. Robert just hoped they didn't miss their flight to Japan. He had a non-refundable ticket that couldn't be changed, and he didn't want to lose it. He was sure the baby would be all right once they got to Tokyo. Bobby took refuge in the business class galley again for a few minutes, but when she showed up, she reeked of vomit, and they held their noses and told her she had to leave. "I'm sorry. That baby threw up all over everyone. I got it all over me, while I tried to help them clean up." "Don't you have a change of uniform?" Nancy asked her, as Bobby shook her head and tried to keep her distance, but you could smell her from a block away, and she finally left them to return to coach. "I'm not working coach again," she told them, and then ran back down the aisle as people's heads turned, wondering where the awful smell came from. She wondered if the others would even let her take the airport shuttle with them. She'd have to take a cab in from the airport, and the cab driver wouldn't like it either. It was a hideous end to an already bad flight for her, and she heard the same couple arguing again as she rushed past them. They never stopped, and she wondered if they enjoyed it, or why they didn't just get divorced instead of torturing each other. In the cockpit, Helen had asked Jason to tidy up their paperwork and to continue to keep the cockpit sterile after they descended to 10,000 feet until they landed. He did as she said, and then sat down and glared at her, wondering when she was going to give up the controls and let him land the plane, as she had said she would. She didn't say anything to him, as she continued to watch the skies for visible air traffic. Connor Gray's eyes were closed, and he looked as though he was praying. He was about to land in his captain's uniform for the last time. It was a day he had never thought would come, and he knew only too well how much he would miss flying. He hadn't been ready for this sudden end to his career, but now he had to face it, just as he'd had to come to terms with his wife's death. He had a sense of inevitability about his life, as though he no longer controlled any of it. Destiny made all the decisions. He didn't see Jason watching him with a look of contempt. He thought Connor was a pathetic old man. Helen appeared calm as the flight drew to a close. She looked completely unperturbed, and no one would have suspected that her heart was pounding in her chest. She could sense danger all around her. She'd had the same feeling of impending doom when the terrorists had released the video of Jack. It was as though her body knew that something terrible was about to happen before her mind did, and every fiber of her being was on the alert. She just didn't know for what. But like with the video that had changed their lives forever, she knew she'd find out soon enough. All she could do was brace herself and deal with it when it happened, whatever it was. She was ready, and anticipating the worst. Chapter 7 Two Homeland Security agents showed up in plain clothes at UCSF Hospital, at the new campus downtown in the vicinity of the ballpark, and parked in the garage. It was a long walk to the surgical floor where Jason's ex-girlfriend worked. They'd been given a code by their boss that told them it was urgent and a top-secret investigation. They knew the identity of the subject they were to ask about, but didn't know exactly the reason for concern. They knew he was a pilot. He was currently on a plane, and it was time-sensitive. The plane was due to land in less than 3 hours. But they had no other details. They'd been told he had anger issues, and their boss wanted to know more about his potential for violence. Alan Wexler, the head of the San Francisco office, had assigned a man and a woman to do the job. Paul Gilmore and Lucy Hobbs had worked together for 2 years, and Paul had agreed to let Lucy do the talking. The girl they were seeing was young, and more likely to open up to a woman about her ex-boyfriend. She was 27 years old and a surgical nurse at the hospital. Lucy was only a few years older. In jeans with a long ponytail, running shoes, and a baseball cap, she looked like a kid. Paul Gilmore was 50, nearing retirement, and had children older than she was. But he had learned from working with her that Lucy was a dedicated agent and one of the smartest he'd ever worked with. He had done everything possible to avoid working with her when they were assigned to each other as partners, but had defended her hotly ever since. She had kept him from getting shot on their first operation together, and she had won his undying loyalty. He trusted her instincts about the girl they were about to see. "How much do you want to bet that if she moved on to a new guy, her ex considers that cheating on him? Guys with anger issues do that," Lucy commented on their walk to orthopedic surgery, where the girl worked. "Stop being such a cynic," he told her. "Not everybody cheats. Only my ex-wife." She had left him for his former partner, which had caused him to be reassigned to Lucy. He had been a mess when they started working together, but with her easy, breezy, down-to-earth and sensible way of looking at things, she had gotten him through it. He had talked of nothing else for their first year as partners and had had a crazed moment of wanting to go out with Lucy. She had told him reasonably that it was a dumb idea. He didn't mean it, and he'd regret it. and she'd been right. For the past 6 months, he'd been dating an undercover DEA agent, and was happier than he'd been in years. Lucy had been dating the same guy for the past 4 years. He was a flying instructor and glider pilot, and didn't give a damn about the kind of work she did. He was just happy to see her whenever she was free. They never talked about her work, and he had gotten her into skydiving, which Paul told her was insane. He said he'd rather be shot than jump out of an airplane with a parachute, but Lucy loved it. She said it relieved all her tension after work, which he said confirmed what he'd known about her all along. She was insane, which she admitted freely. I didn't say she's cheating. I said that if her ex has anger issues, he probably considers a new relationship infidelity to him. Paul knew Lucy was probably right. She was smart about people and relationships. The direction they'd been given was about the subject's rages, if he was ever abusive with her, or ever hurt her physically, and if she considered him dangerous to other people. He didn't sound like a good guy to Paul, nor to Lucy, although they'd both heard worse about other people they investigated, and they knew time was of the essence. They asked for Bianca Martinez when they got to the nursing desk of the orthopedic surgical floor, and were told by the attendant on duty that she was in surgery and wouldn't be out for some time. Paul had done the talking, and they hadn't shown their badges, but the answer they'd been given was not the one they wanted, or that Ben needed in New York. And the code assigned to their mission told them that some time was not going to do it for them. "I'm sorry," he said quietly, with a voice of authority that didn't require a gun or uniform. Most people reacted instantly when he put that voice on, and Lucy always laughed about it and made fun of him. She called it his voice of God act, and it usually made people jump when he told them to. The woman at the desk was not impressed, and Paul discreetly took out his badge and showed it to her. "We need to see her on an urgent matter of national security," he said in his God voice, and the attendant looked up at him, evaluating him. "Is she in trouble? Are you arresting her?" He could tell that the attendant was indulging her own curiosity for the sake of gossip later, but he decided to satisfy her, if it got them what he wanted. He was a good judge of people, and so was Lucy. They were an efficient team, and he wondered if they should have come in uniform, even if they didn't have to. But Lucy had thought it would be a bad idea. They had changed into street clothes intentionally, so as not to scare off the young woman they had come to see. "No, she's not in trouble," Paul said quietly. "We need her help with an investigation. How long will she be in surgery?" The woman consulted a list and looked at her watch before she looked back at him. "Another 7 or 8 hours. They just started, if they went in on schedule. It's a spinal surgery. She should be out by 5 or 6. It was 9 o'clock in the morning, and they had only gotten the assignment at 8:15 and had come as quickly as they could. The flight was due to land at 11. "We can't wait," Paul said bluntly, with his God voice getting stronger, and the look on his face told her that he meant it. "They need to get her out of surgery so we can talk to her." The importance of the matter came through his pores as he looked at her. The woman hesitated for a moment, and then nodded and got off the stool where she was sitting. "I'll see what I can do. I don't know if they'll let her out to talk to you. I'd hate to have to go into the operating room to get her," he said, as Lucy smiled sweetly at the woman and looked innocent. No one would have guessed that she was a master marksman and deadly with almost any kind of weapon in her hands. Her father had been a cop, and she had wanted to be in law enforcement all her life and was good at it. She had 4 brothers who were SFPD cops, and she had trumped them all by signing on with Homeland Security. She had been debating between that and the FBI as soon as she got out of college, and had worked undercover drug cases for several years before she and Paul teamed up. His specialty was more national security and international terrorism, which Lucy always told him was tame by comparison. They were both pros, and her brothers had always called her the Gladiator, because she would fight them to the death once they picked on her, and she never gave up, no matter how much pain they inflicted on her. The woman from the nursing desk came back 10 minutes later. "She'll be out as soon as they can replace her." "How long will that be?" Lucy asked her, impatient with the woman's vague explanations. "If it's more than 5 minutes, we're going in to get her," Lucy said with steel in her eyes. The woman disappeared again without saying a word and came back 5 minutes later with her supervisor. Both agents reached for their badges and showed them to her, with stern faces that usually frightened people, especially